district judge, who went to excruciating pains on all forms of details, wrote a 107-page opinion, which I think is astounding, at least in my experience, in terms of the attention, meticulous attention to specific facts and findings, and says on the basis of the evidence that has been reviewed, and there is substantial, I mean, deposition testimony and all that, yes, I think that no reasonable juror could find otherwise with regard to these facts. This was one organization. You can't hide the fact that it's one organization by calling yourself IAP, IAP National, IAP California, IAP Illinois, and AMS, and then say, well, AMS is different from all this if it's the same leaders. There's a whole series of people who have been presidents of this organization, Yasser Bushnak, Omar Ahmad, Rafiq Jabber. These are all people who acknowledge the sequence of leadership in which they're essentially one organization. And then they come into this court and they say, well, no, we're a separate organization. We were formed separately. They weren't. It's one sequence. And so that's what the district judge found. The fact is, and I would like to deal at some point, certainly in the substantial amount of time I have, with the collateral estoppel issue, which I think is a substantial, at least from my perspective, probably the one really substantial legal issue here. But on the factual questions, did Hamas kill David Boehm? It's extraordinary. You have, in this case, two identified killers, identified at the time that the murder takes place. Immediately, Hamas takes credit for this. They've taken credit for it from the time it began until today. The district judge didn't say this was evidence that had to be stricken because it was inadmissible. The district judge said, I don't have to reach that evidence. Okay, Salah says I shouldn't consider it. I have other evidence with regard to Salah. I don't need that. If you look at Judge Key's opinion, he doesn't say this is inadmissible evidence.
10. Yeah, I mean...
The evidence.
Do you think it's an admission? I mean, of course, an organization doesn't do anything. An organization acts through people, and there was Mr. Hanawi and the other guy. And so is it that you're saying that there's functionally an admission on the
absolutely.
Part of
people? Absolutely.
Other
we think
people in
that,
the
that the fact that an organization puts on its internet, we take credit for this. This law can't be enforced. I put to the court that if, in fact, the Boehm decision that this court rendered in 2002 is ever going to be enforced, it can't be enforced if what you say is when a terrorist organization takes credit for it and continues through 10 years to take credit for it until the death of Mr. Hanawi. Mr. Hanawi died a little over 2 years ago. He was working for Hamas. He encountered in Nablus Israeli troops, apparently, was killed. Hamas glorifies him in newspaper stories 2 weeks ago. They've taken credit for all the wonderful things that they say Mr. Hanawi did. And then a court is going to say at some point, look, there's a gap in the evidence. We don't know whether Hanawi is Hamas, and we don't know whether Hamas killed David Boehm. The whole world knows that Hamas killed David Boehm. Hamas says Hamas killed David Boehm. It can only be lawyers who can stand up in court and say, well, you haven't proven it because you haven't put in a piece of paper, when in fact the internet postings say it, a report of the State Department that was there at the time of Hanawi's trial before a Palestinian Authority court. We're not talking about an Israeli court.
You know what worries me a little bit, though? Maybe this actually takes us over into the offensive collateral estoppel argument, which I'm very interested to hear from you on. Over the last few years, we have seen in the news a lot of things, you know, that everybody knew turning out not to be true. You know, were there yellow cake sales in Niger, and were there weapons of mass destruction and all this? And this was everybody knew that these things were there until it turned out everybody didn't know those things were there. And this is a world where verification of information can be quite difficult given the natural methods of intelligence officers. Well, if you're talking about the president's Article II power to conduct war, maybe that's the best you have to that's what you have to deal with. If you're talking about a civil lawsuit in the tort realm, I wonder whether you're just saying there are some different rules for tort lawsuits under this statute, or whether somehow there are different standards of proof or whether this meets the ordinary standards of proof.
I don't think that there are different rules. I mean, we acknowledge that the rules are the same rules. But even with regard to hearsay, it is recognized that there are circumstances under which hearsay, because it has indicia of credibility, is accepted. In this case, an internet posting by an organization we submit is an admission against interest by that organization. To say the organization Hamas did not kill David Boehm, if they have been taking credit for it, it's not like it would be if Saddam Hussein had, during this entire period when there was an issue of whether he had weapons of mass destruction, if he had announced publicly, I have weapons of mass destruction. I am telling you they are here and I'm proud of it. I think one could legitimately say, well, you can accept that. That's an admission against interest. He has said it. Hamas has said it on its internet and has said it repeatedly. And as I say, beyond that, you have the trial of Mr. Hanawi in a Palestinian court attended by a State Department representative. Whether one says that report, which reports in detail about the trial and about his admission, I submit it has indicia of reliability, and it's something that this court can look at, even if Judge Keyes said, I don't really need it to determine whether the summary judgment can be entered against Saleh.
I have a very specific question for you. The Watson memorandum seems to have figured prominently in Judge Keyes' summary judgment ruling. Is that memorandum unsworn?
It's unsworn? Yes, I think it is unsworn. But it's, again, it's an official document. It seems to me it is something that he could rely on.
Is this the type of hearsay that you believe can be relied on?
I think it can be relied on in these circumstances.
After Crawford?
Pardon?
After the Supreme Court's decision in Crawford?
Well, I think, again, with an official document of this kind, I think it could be relied on. I mean, a report that was done under the circumstances in which the Watson memorandum was put in could be relied on. I don't know to what extent, again, in terms of the trial record, that there was, you know, specific objection made on that basis to it. But I think he could rely on the Watson memorandum. He could rely on the things that that underlay it.
So it's enough to prove a point that our government has, through its intelligence operations, come to a conclusion about somebody, that they are, in fact, terrorists or
no,
whatever
let,
the conclusion
may be? Let me make clear,
be.
In answer to a question I know that you asked counsel previously, Judge Wood, we are not relying and did not rely in this case on the fact that there was a designation of the Holy Land Foundation in December of 2001. As a matter of fact, we didn't rely on any evidence after the murder of David Boehm. We brought this lawsuit before the designation of the Holy Land Foundation. And consequently, the evidence that we are relying on is all evidence that precedes that day in May 13th, 1996, when David Boehm was murdered. And it's on that basis that we think the standards set out in this court's earlier opinion were met without regard to any subsequent designation.
Did you attempt to make a showing of but-for causation below?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think we felt, and let me address that point if I might. But-for causation, and it's exactly as it literally means if not for what this individual did, the result would not have happened. That's a but-for causation. That makes sense in various tort contexts, but it has never been applied in considering either aiding and abetting law or conspiracy law. There are many conspirators in every conspiracy who you can't say are essential to the outcome of whatever the illegal activity was. But under the standards of conspiracy law and under the standards of this court's opinion in 2002, these are people who aided, who intended, who knew of the illegal activity that was going on, who intended to further it, and who took some step in furtherance of it.
But, you know, in a usual conspiracy case, and as you rightly pointed out, you know, we see these much more in the criminal context, there will be some care taken to prove the scope of the agreement, the period of time the agreement covered, whether the person who joined the agreement knew about that, and what acts, you know, if it's necessary. Of course, sometimes it's just enough to prove that you agreed, but if it's an overt act kind of conspiracy, what acts to support the conspiracy? And I find a lot of this kind of assumed here.
Well, I don't think it's assumed. I think what happens in these terrorism cases, and to that extent it is different from, you know, the drug conspiracy, the terrorist organizations that are being financed have ongoing activities over a course of years to carry out, because their program is not one that's geared to the transportation of specific narcotics and realizing profit on particular narcotics. The whole program of terrorism is a program that relies on continuous killings, continuous terrorisms, as it were. And therefore, the conspiracy doesn't have a termination date the way an ordinary conspiracy does. Hamas has still not, to this date, finished with its terrorist program. If somebody joined the terrorist program, even in 1989, even in 1993, that person was a party to the continuing terrorism, the continuing activities. As I say, the outline in the Marzouk case is chilling in various ways, because if one compares it to this case, this is part of the sequence of murdering innocent civilians.
So, and if somebody were to give a donation to Hamas today, and then in the year 2020, Hamas kills somebody, that person is liable under your theory?
Well, again, Judge
directly
Wood,
to Hamas,
I want to distinguish the individual contributor. I mean, we have
An organization. Anyway, Homeland
Foundation. An organization continues.
Homeland Foundation gives a contribution directly to Hamas today. And in the year 2020, Hamas goes out in the street and murders another innocent young man.
And has done
liable?
Nothing. If Hamas has done nothing between now and 2020, no. Then I say, well, how can you tie the contribution is given to a hospital today? But assuming Hamas every month murders somebody else between now and 2020, if the organization doesn't sever its tie, the fact is, withdrawal from conspiracy is something you can do. The Holy Land Foundation could have said in 1994, in 1995, public statement, we disclaim any support of killing of innocent civilians. We reject it.
Isn't that what their affidavits say? I mean, you may disagree with the truth of them, of course, but I mean, isn't that what they're saying?
No, they say they didn't contribute. They claim, and this leads into the collateral estoppel issue, because they claim, and they've done it again today, we didn't fund Hamas. We deny that we gave Hamas any money. They don't say we withdrew from any conspiracy by the standards of withdrawal. There are affirmative standards of withdrawal which require...
Well, aren't they trying to say we were never part of it? I mean, you know...
Well, I know, but that's exactly the point. The point is, when an individual who's charged with conspiracy and there's proof that he engaged in that conspiracy says, I was never a conspirator, then he's fighting with the evidence, or he's disagreeing with the evidence that he ever became a conspirator in the first place. An individual who says, I withdrew from the conspiracy, if the Holy Land Foundation said today, we were members of that conspiracy, if they had said in the trial below, we were members of that conspiracy, but look, here are public statements we made before David Boyne was killed, in which we attacked the conspirators. We said, this is outrageous and illegal. We call on Hamas to stop all these murders. We're making public statements, and we will report to the police any effort to kill people in the future. They could argue they withdrew. They were members and they withdrew. There was no suggestion of any such evidence. They did exactly the same thing through 1996 that they had done before. And what they had done before is they invited a veiled Hamas representative to their meeting to speak about how much he was benefited by the Holy Land Foundation's contributions. They engaged in conversations that were overheard in 1993 talking about how they were trying to undermine any peace prospects and engage in violence. This is not a case of withdrawal. There are standards for withdrawal, and this is not a case of a withdrawal from a conspiracy. It's a case in which they challenge whether they were ever conspirators in the first place. And that's why I say that issue was determined by the D.C. Circuit. Your Honor, Judge Rovner, asked, well, did the D.C. Circuit disagree with this court in terms of its standards? I submit it did not. First of all,
they seem not to require any proof of intent.
They did not, but, Your Honor, they didn't address it because nobody presented that to them. If in fact, the Holy Land Foundation...
Did they have the opportunity to present it to them?
Yes, of course. They presented affidavits. They presented briefs. The point
Why was intent relevant to an IEPA designation for the Office of Foreign Asset Control as opposed to a tort aiding and abetting theory?
It's relevant to the First Amendment claim that the Holy Land Foundation made in the D.C. Circuit. Let me point out this. When we talk about collateral estoppel in the Park Lane hosiery situation and other cases where the Supreme Court and other courts have considered offensive collateral estoppel, the question has been, is the party against whom you are using it, did that have a fair opportunity to present the factual issue that the court decided?
And right, and precisely that. I mean, and what bothers me is really the distinction between the president exercising his authority under IEPA to make these designations and the truncated procedures and the type of evidence that might be appropriate for that and a tort suit. Suppose this were civil RICO. Suppose this were, you know, an antitrust action. I mean, you would not allow hearsay evidence and all sorts of other things to permit the plaintiffs to carry their burden of persuasion either at trial or at summary judgment, either way. I mean, you have evidentiary standards, and I don't see the evidentiary standards that apply, perhaps quite rightly so. I mean, I'm not attacking the D.C. Circuit's opinion at all, but it's a different kind of case.
Well, let me explain why I think the factual issue is precisely the one that the D.C. Circuit considered.
But the procedures, too, is what I'm trying to focus on.
And the procedures. The Holy Land Foundation, when its assets were seized and it was designated, had various options. They could have chosen not to challenge that at all and simply to come into this court and say, the court below, and say, look, we are not, you know, whatever they did in that case, whatever was done in terms of the seizure of our assets, we did not fund Hamas, and we want to have a trial here on whether we funded Hamas. They chose not to do that. They chose instead they were going to challenge the seizure. All right. When they challenged the seizure in the district court and ultimately in the Court of Appeals, they could have challenged it, as Your Honor has said, under the Administrative Procedure Act. Is it arbitrary and capricious? The standards that apply with regard to administrative determinations.
And there, I would say, even the application of an arbitrary and capricious standard might be influenced by the president's Article 2 powers in the case of this kind of designation. In other words, it might, in application, be different from, you know, some National Labor Relations Board, you know, decision or something.
Yes. But had they done that, and only that, I submit, Your Honor, I don't think I could stand up here today and say it's offensive collateral estoppel. Because Your Honor's right. The standard is different. Arbitrary and capricious is different than the standard that that court would then have been asked to decide. But they went beyond that. They made a deliberate, tactical, or I don't know who made that determination for them, but they made a choice. And they said, we're not only going to attack it under the Administrative Procedure Act, we're going to attack it under the Constitution. And we're going to say that under the Claiborne Hardware case, you can't do this to us because, and the D.C. Circuit quotes it, because they had no knowing affiliation with Hamas or any other terrorist organization. They didn't just say this was arbitrary and capricious, there was secret evidence, there was all sorts of procedural things. They said we have a constitutional right because we had no knowing affiliation with Hamas.
And that's why I'm focusing on the procedural side of things, because I'm not aware of any Claiborne Hardware case where an adjudication of your First Amendment rights happens when you didn't have a chance to see any of the evidence that was being introduced against you.
As I stand here, I can't cite to you a particular Claiborne Hardware case. But that very issue was presented to the D.C. Circuit.
But the procedural opportunities, which is the language of Park Lane Hosiery, were different.
Correct.
There was no opportunity to see the evidence, and so...
But, Your Honor, that's exactly
that's
what
the
they
situation
said.
Situation when offensive issue preclusion is not used.
They raised the substantive and procedural issue to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit not only rejected the substantive issue, rejected the procedural issue,
but if I might just continue for one minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, Arne.
I was just going to say, as you know, it's up to the second court to decide how much preclusive effect to give the first court's action. It's not up to the first court to pre-announce how much.
I understand that. And it's also true that this court's view is, and standard of review, as we said in the supplementary letter, is abuse of discretion. Did the district court abuse its discretion? That's in the Ross Sternberg case. Out of this court, which says that's the standard. Did the district court abuse its discretion in granting offensive collateral estoppel effect? But what I was going to say, and I apologize for interrupting, Your Honor. What I was going to say is not only did they raise the procedural issue to the D.C. Circuit, but they raised it on the in-bank petition, and they raised it to the Supreme Court in a certiorari petition. Their certiorari petition says, look what the D.C. Circuit did to us. The D.C. Circuit, and I quote, resolved the central factual issue, the central factual dispute in the case in the government's favor on the basis of this procedural, you know, shortcut and all this sort of thing. The Supreme Court denied certiorari.
Which we know means nothing, by the way.
It means nothing, Your Honor, except for purposes of offensive collateral estoppel, I submit a party can't get up before this court. The purpose of offensive collateral estoppel, after all, is economy of judicial resources and respect for another court before whom they have made their claim.
But it's very difficult for me to think that the Supreme Court, or for that matter the D.C. Circuit evaluating an in-bank petition, would have viewed that case as anything but an IEPA case, where they might have thought, for that kind of case, these procedures were adequate. So we're not going to give you a hearing, whereas our case isn't an IEPA case.
Your Honor, if you say that, then you're saying that the D.C. Circuit's opinion was gratuitously broad. The D.C. Circuit said that the ample record evidence establishing Holy Land Foundation's role in the funding of Hamas and of its terrorist activities is incontrovertible. That's not a little word. That's not saying, well, it's sufficient for purposes of IEPA, but maybe they'll be able to prove it differently. The D.C. Circuit has said, hearing the procedural arguments, hearing the substantive arguments, this is incontrovertible. Incontrovertible is summary judgment language. That means there's no reasonable juror could find otherwise. That's what incontrovertible means.
But and you if know, we give people their day in court. In a lot of circumstances, you know, maybe even one defendant will have been present before and another not. And we do let people at least try to persuade a new fact finder.
Of course.
So the D.C. Circuit said that. I don't doubt they thought that. Why should I doubt that? But, well, we have procedural norms.
I understand. But if the D.C. Circuit said it and they concluded it on the basis of their review of the evidence and on the basis of the argument that the Holy Land Foundation made procedurally, that is, it's not res judicata in a very technical sense, but we submit it is ample for a district court to say, I apply Park Lane Hosiery. These people had an opportunity to try to persuade a court equal in stature to this court, the D.C. Circuit, that they were not, had no knowing affiliation with Hamas. That is the factual issue. Was intent mentioned to the D.C. Circuit? No, intent was not mentioned to the D.C. Circuit, but I submit that if you find that the role in the funding of Hamas and of its terror and of its terrorist activities is incontrovertible, and of its terrorist activities, we submit that means somebody who funds and incontrovertibly funds and knows terrorist activities, that is an individual who or an organization that you can say has had its day in court. That's the issue. The issue isn't whether this court would have issued the same ruling, whether this court might have thought the procedure was inadequate. The issue is, did the D.C. Circuit decide it? And we submit the D.C. Circuit decided it. The D.C. Circuit could, had it wanted to, have taken the route that the district judge did, Judge Kessler. What Judge Kessler said was, under Claiborne Hardware, you don't have to prove knowledge. And I guess you don't have to prove intent under Claiborne Hardware. The D.C. Circuit did not do that. The D.C. Circuit said the evidence is incontrovertible. And that's when these folks voluntarily presented it to the D.C. Circuit. They didn't abandon it. They didn't then say, oh, my goodness, we've got to go back to Judge Keyes and make our case now before Judge Keyes. They said, hey, that's wrong. We're going to go to the in-bank court. They went to the in-bank court. They were denied. They went to the Supreme Court, and they said to the Supreme Court in a petition for certiorari, it's true, certiorari denial has no significance, but in terms of offensive collateral estoppel, we think it is significant that they were able and did, in fact, make that argument to the Supreme Court of the United States in the cert petition, and cert was denied. So they can't now come back and say, oh, my goodness, totally surprised.
I don't understand that to be their argument. I understand their argument to be that the set of procedural tools, as it were, that they had at their disposal in the D.C. litigation was a vastly diminished one compared to what ordinary civil litigation would be.
Correct.
So even though under that set of disadvantages they weren't able to prevail, they would like to go through it now with normal rules of evidence, normal procedural protections.
Well, that's what happens in offensive collateral estoppel.
No, it doesn't. Offensive collateral estoppel means that you had roughly the same procedural tools.
No,
on both
I don't
sides.
Think so. Oh, I think the standards in the Park Lane hosiery are not that you have to have the same procedural standards. The standards that Park Lane hosiery has set up is that you need the incentive, you have to have somebody who's up there litigating for you, and you have to decide the same factual issue.
No, but Park Lane hosiery also says we aren't going to be as extensive with offensive issue preclusions we are with defensive, because there can be situations. I mean, what the court was thinking about is, you know, there you are in a small claims court and such and such, and then later on you're in a court with full-blown procedural protections. But there can be all kinds of, you know, if you were tried before a military tribunal and then somehow you got before a regular court, you might want to make the argument that you actually have a right to counsel in a regular court that's not constricted.
True.
There are lots of asymmetrical sequences of procedures that could happen. Their argument, at least, obviously disagree, but their argument is this is one of them.
Right. And we submit that is an argument which they made to the district judge. The district judge rejected it, said offensive collateral estoppel is appropriate, and this court's standard is, did he abuse his discretion?
Procedures, at least.
Did he abuse his discretion? Because, as I say, in all these cases, in Park Lane hosiery itself, it was a lawsuit against the SEC. That's not to say the same procedures would have applied and did in a simply lawsuits between two private parties. It happens in all these offensive collateral estoppel cases that you're involved almost by definition in a first lawsuit in which the party who's using offensive collateral estoppel could not even join that lawsuit in any way. And in this case, indeed, I submit it cuts the other way in various ways. We, as ordinary non-government parties, did not have access to secret evidence, which apparently was put into the record in that case. They had access to all the non-secret evidence. They had an opportunity to put in their affidavits. True, they didn't have live testimony, but nonetheless, they can't say nobody heard their denials. They had an opportunity to put in affidavits. And nonetheless, the D.C. Circuit chose very deliberately, I submit, not only to rule against them, but to rule against them without taking Judge Kessler's approach, which is under Claiborne Hardware, we don't have to reach this. We don't have to reach Claiborne Hardware standards here because it's simply an administrative determination. And to use words that I submit, it would be, in a certain sense, an insult to the D.C. Circuit to say we're going to ignore. They said incontrovertible, specifically about whether the allegation and the constitutional issue as to whether there was knowing affiliation with Hamas or any other territorial organization. So, therefore, we submit this is a case where it was appropriate and correct to say to them, you can't take a second bite at the apple. You made a voluntary choice. You weren't dragged into the D.C. Circuit. You voluntarily went into the D.C. courts. You weren't forced to make a constitutional claim. You voluntarily made a constitutional claim. You presented all that to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit said, incontrovertibly, you were a knowing funder of Hamas and of its terrorist activities. That is the issue in this case. That's exactly the factual issue in this case, and that's why it's appropriate to hold them to that determination.
I want to go back to the but-for causation. You say you didn't attempt to make a showing of but-for causation. Am I correct?
I think that's correct.
If this court were to determine that cause, in fact, must be shown, are you saying that you cannot make that showing?
If cause, in fact, means showing that the contribution was done either with the knowledge that David Boehm was going to be the person who was going to be killed or that the gun was going to be purchased with the money that was being contributed, yes, I am saying we could not make that. And I think that would, I submit to Your Honor, with all respect, that would totally gut Section 2333. If that showing were required, then it would not only gut the statute, but the effect of this court's decision. And this court's decision in 2002 has been a landmark opinion, which has been followed by courts all over the country.
Let's look at 2333. It gives a right to sue to people who are injured by reason of an act of international terrorism, which here would be either giving material support to Hamas or aiding and abetting its terrorist activities. Doesn't the by reason of language suggest that causation, in fact, needs to be shown?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what by reason of means is that the ultimate act, the killing of David Boehm, is what caused the injury. Usual principles of tort law, and this court was very careful in its original opinion to say, look, the statute doesn't say who you can sue. So we go back to tort law. We go back to the restatement. The restatement has talked about that. The Halberstam case has talked about that. And therefore, what we say is you can sue if you're an American citizen and you've been injured by an act of international terrorism.
But, you know, we said in Boehm 1 that Congress meant to embrace traditional tort theories of causation. And isn't cause, in fact, a bedrock tort principle?
Not, I submit, for tort liability based on civil conspiracy or aiding and abetting. The restatement of torts, which the opinion in Halberstam quotes, says that you could be liable without being a but-for cause. It defines it, that the three subsections, and they all indicate that if you're an aider and abetter or a conspirator, that you would be liable even if you're not a but-for cause. So I don't believe that this court in its original opinion was applying a standard of but-for causation, and I submit that would be the wrong standard under this statute. You could not carry out the purposes of this statute if that were a requirement that plaintiffs would have to make, because terrorist organizations are not like corporations in the United States. You can't take discovery of their books and records to find out, you know, where did the money go? Was it actually used to buy this gun? Was it actually used to buy this bomb? Was it actually used to pay this suicide bomber? There's no way you'll ever be able to find that out. So let me just turn very, very briefly. I don't exactly know how much time I have left. My yellow light is still not.
15 minutes.
Oh, all right. Let me turn briefly, if I might, to some of the other arguments that have been made in this case. With regard to the...
Oh, before you do, is there any official document in the record that would reflect the conviction of Mr. Hinawi, or is it just Mr. Zabek's notes?
To my knowledge, just Mr. Zabek's notes.
Why wouldn't there be an official public record available to establish his conviction?
It's a Palestinian Authority court. All that I can say is, the State Department, after all, sent an observer to watch this proceeding. What the Palestinian Authority courts do, after all, they're not a government, what they do with the records of their proceedings, who knows? Clearly, what happens with their sentences is really strange. I mean, here's Mr. Hanawi sentenced to 10 years at hard labor, and shortly thereafter he's walking around a free man, and with substantially less than 10 years after this conviction, he's wandering around in Nablus finally when he encounters Israeli troops and is killed in a shootout. So this whole proceeding, this whole court proceeding, one has to rely on the official State Department report, which is what that is, a State Department observer going there. And we submit that if, in fact, this court were to look at those underlying exhibits, this court could determine that that would be admissible for purposes of making the determination. Let me turn to the questions of continuance, which the court discussed with Mr. Beal. First of all, as we state in our brief, although Mr. Beal now says, just 2 months, the fact is the request was an open-ended one. It was, look, I want a continuance. It was not, give me a week, give me 2 weeks, and then maybe I'll be able to be prepared. It was totally open-ended. And then later on, now he says, well, all I really wanted was 2 months. Well, he didn't tell that to the district judge. Second of all, as Your Honor said, there are many cases where there are multiple defendants, and these are not multiple defendants who are hostile to each other. At least, again, we're not parties to the defense discussions. But one thinks that to the extent they are able to cooperate, if somebody else was supposed to be taking care of a major part of the defense of a trial, if it was going to trial, Mr. Beal could ask them and say, please give me whatever files you've got or whatever cross-examinations you would have or whatever evidence you would have. No indication that that was not possible. Third of all, they never made any designation, QLI, of expert witnesses, of anything like that. It's not a case where one can say, look, there was a lot of preparation that had to go into this kind of a trial. And finally,
while you're on that point, was there simultaneously with the summary judgment schedule a time for a final pretrial order by which all those designations?
Yes, the judge set the trial.
I mean, you had submitted your list of
everything
that you
wanted. The trial was set to start on that date,
and none of the defendants, I take it. Was this date before or after the summary judgment?
The date was set before the summary judgment.
So had the other defendants designated?
Yes, other defendants had designated, but QLI had not.
Okay.
But again, if Mr. Beal was going to be presenting or wanted to present them, let him ask the other counsel who was suddenly out of the case because of the summary judgment. I mean, I've been in many trials with co-defendants, and, you work together. If one defendant for some reason or another drops out, if a case against him is dismissed or something, then if you're working together, you get his files, you prepare for trial. This was a case where he knew when the trial was. The state had been set, quite frankly. When he showed up, everybody expected he was going to be doing something at trial. And suddenly he announces, I'm not ready, I'm not proceeding. We submit that's a waiver. That's the clearest case of waiving whatever claims you might make. The lawyer is there, he's able to present a defense at trial, and he doesn't do it. Well, he has made a tactical choice. He's afraid that he's going to be criticized for being an ineffective counsel at trial. Well, where were you all these months prior to trial when you should have been preparing for trial? You can't suddenly say, look, I was counting on my colleagues to do it, and therefore I can't represent somebody, even though I knew that the trial was then. So from our perspective, that is clearly a waiver.
Mr. Lewin, let me just ask you, the Unger case, how do we factor in what occurred, or do we factor in what occurred yesterday?
What occurred yesterday, you mean the denial of certiorari? Well, the Unger case, to my knowledge, is a default judgment. The Supreme Court denied certiorari in the case of a default judgment in which there had been a judgment entered not against the Holy Land Foundation. Again, it's a judgment entered against Hamas, which never showed up for a trial. So we don't think it's really relevant to this case. This is the first case in which there has been a contested claim that went through a trial, or went through trial proceedings, summary proceedings, and you know, our view is that certainly to the extent that the younger plaintiffs have a judgment by default, they can go out and enforce it against whatever the appropriate party is in that case. But we don't think it affects this case, quite frankly, Your Honor.
Well, why wouldn't it? If these defendants are found in cahoots with Hamas, why wouldn't that judgment in supplementary proceedings be sought to be enforced against them?
Our position, this is a matter for, you know, separate presentation, but our position is that the Holy Land Foundation is a separate entity which was funding Hamas. If you sue the Holy Land Foundation, you can recover against the assets of the Holy Land Foundation. If you sue Hamas, you can recover against the assets of Hamas, but not against the assets of the Holy Land Foundation, which is a separate entity, even if it was funding Hamas.
Well, that's for another day.
That is for another day, Your Honor. That's true. And hopefully not for other litigation. We hope it doesn't end up in that that form. With regard to Mr. Sala's claims, he was in prison at the time David Boehm was killed. He was from prison writing a long confession and explanation as to how he was supporting all the things Hamas was doing. The Pinkerton case makes it clear you can still be a member of a conspiracy even while you're sitting in jail. And if there's ever any very clear kind of model of that, it is Mr. Sala, who was sitting in jail and telling his Hamas confederates how to act while he's sitting in jail. He didn't withdraw from the conspiracy because he was there. Long confession in which he recites all that. And then besides that, one of the things that I think the appellants in this case continue to overlook is the invocation of the Fifth Amendment, which in a civil case, after all, can be used against them. And so with regard to Mr. Sala, you have the fact that he was a party to the conspiracy, that he never withdrew, that his confession describes his participation, that he was involved in funding Hamas with large amounts of money, for which he was ultimately arrested in Israel and convicted in Israel, and took the Fifth Amendment. That's more than ample, we submit, for him to be standing up in this court and saying, well, there was no evidence against me, and, you know, I'm being railroaded in this case in some way. With regard to the Paz affidavit, which we have relied on for the fact that Hamas killed David Boehm. They never sought to depose Mr. Paz. They didn't make any objection based on the Daubert case. The affidavit is in the record. If one has to look beyond the internet, the website admissions of Hamas, and beyond the report of Hinawi's conviction of Palestinian court, you can look at the Paz affidavit, and that's what we've relied on in our briefs, and we think that that amply supports the conclusion that could be made that and that should have been made, and that really to the whole world, I agree, Judge Wood, that there are things which the whole world accepts, and nonetheless in a court of law you have to test. But it is bizarre, quite frankly, to hear at this stage, even though they asserted it at various points below, but to hear at this stage of the litigation, after Mr. Hanawi has been extolled on his passing by Hamas for all the things he did, including the murder of David Boehm, well, we don't know that Hamas killed David Boehm. It's true, they don't have a burden. But if you're going to present some argument to a court of appeals at this juncture that Hamas did not kill David Boehm, at the very least, they should have presented something to the district court that says, here's an alternative theory. David Boehm was killed by some fellow who was doing target practice out in Bethel and was happening to ride around and killed him. He was killed by his friend who took out a gun and shot him in the head. What is his theory? There's no theory because it didn't happen that way. He was killed by Hamas. When I was walking to court this morning on the street, I happened to see a newspaper headline about a totally different case, which says, "Justice for a horrible crime." Well, that's what this case is about. We're here at this stage, finally, after almost 10 years. We're coming to 2006. In May of 2006, it will be 10 years since this young man, since David Boyum, was murdered. On a trip to Israel soon after his murder, I met his grieving parents, his mother, Joyce Boyum, who has told us that at this very moment that I'm here, she will be reciting Psalms before the Western Wall in Jerusalem as I speak. I discovered then that her son was immensely popular with his classmates, with teachers, very highly gifted. His friends and relatives published a hard-covered volume, which I don't have with me today, in his memory. He was charitable. He was kind. He was funny. He was cut down at the age of 17. I was asked, could something be done to prevent others from suffering from this? Something under American law. And I returned to the United States and found Section 2333, which had never somehow been invoked. We brought this action in May of 2000, before 9/11. It was argued in this court shortly after 9/11. I'm sure this court will recall that. And the decision of this court is a landmark in this area. It's been cited, we say in our brief, more than 40 times. It's the guidepost for all kinds of other cases that have been brought. And after this court's decision, we were fortunate enough that my colleague, Mr. Landis, and Mr. Hurwitz, of the firm of Wildman, Harold, Allen, and Dixon, undertook the Herculean task of taking this case to litigation before Judge Keyes, who gave it meticulous, painstaking, careful deliberation every stage. And now the Boyum case looms over all other terrorism litigation. In some ways, the fact that people speak of the Boyum case is really a tribute to David Boyum, this young man at the age of 17. He will live in memory because of the Boyum case. David, the name David, of course, echoes King David. There are psalms that begin, the Hebrew word is Mizmar LeDavid, a hymn to David. There are psalms that begin Tehillah LeDavid, praise to David. And there are psalms that begin Tefillah LeDavid, a prayer to David. This case and our request, our prayer to this court that it affirm this judgment is really Tefillah LeDavid. It's a prayer to David. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewin. Mr. Boyd.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. I hope the court will keep in mind that a great deal of, and no criticism of Mr. Lewin, but a great deal of his time was spent on the Holy Land Foundation issues, and there's a lot that I have to reply to, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. First of all, I hope I don't need to tell the Lewins and their lawyers and the Boyums how much all of us regret that terrible tragedy. But that doesn't change that there's nothing in the record in this case that even comes close to establishing that the Holy Land Foundation had anything to do with it. It's almost as though there's been sort of a pall that has settled over this case, that it doesn't matter what the Holy Land Foundation principals put under oath. The affidavits that were stricken from the record in the D.C. Circuit litigation, the district court litigation, they weren't considered by the court. The court struck them from the record. The court specifically ordered that there will be no discovery and there will be no evidence submitted by the Holy Land Foundation outside the administrative record, that they had no ability, no administrative hearing, no administrative law judge, no participation in creating other than, well, we're thinking about redesignating you, put your affidavits in if you feel like it. But what's settled over this case is that there is sort of this assumption that that there is evidence in the record that the Holy Land Foundation gave money to Hamas, and that somehow the issue is, well, can you really count giving money to Hamas as traceable to the murder of David Boehm? The evidence in the record, the only evidence in the record that is admissible in a court of law, in this or any other court of law, is that they never gave a dime to Hamas. And in fact, if there's any evidence in the record, there is an evidence in the record that was seized, was retrieved from the FBI, seized by the FBI. It's, I think it's a 1997 or 1998 document, series of documents in which the Holy Land Foundation writes to the Janine Zakat Committee and tells its principals, look, we've heard a rumor that you're affiliated with Hamas. A rumor. And so we can't have anything to do with you anymore because we abide by American law. As to the pre-1996 evidence that Mr. Lewin says he's relying on to support the claim, that the Holy Land Foundation was involved in the murder of David Boehm, that evidence consists of receiving $200,000 that was never, there's no evidence that it ever went back to Hamas or to anything other than charity around the world, in Turkey, Chechnya, wherever, from someone who later became affiliated with Hamas or may have been.
Mr. Boyd, could I ask you, when and you're probably going to tell me you don't know because of the record, but anyway,
sure.
I just want to ask, when the D.C. Circuit uses the word that Mr. Lewin stressed, incontrovertible, mm-hmm. about the link between the Holy Land Foundation and Hamas, in its opinion, is there any way to tell whether they're looking at May 1996 evidence or post-May 1996 evidence?
No, there's not, Your Honor. And I think the other thing that's critical about that is that they lump together the secret evidence and the administrative record in that statement. Well, there's nothing in the administrative record that anyone could conceivably characterize as incontrovertible evidence of what they're saying. If there were, the Boehms would have put it in the record here because they had all 3,000 pages. I copied it for them and gave it to them in discovery. And they got all of Holy Land Foundation's, all of the documents that we had copied from the Holy Land Foundation, documents which had been seized by the FBI. So the only thing that they can have been talking about is the secret evidence, and of course, we don't have a clue what that is. But
is it true that you never sought to depose Dr. Paz?
Your Honor, that's correct. We never sought to depose Dr. Paz, and one of the reasons for that, I mean, we've been the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Allowed us to be paid out of Holy Land Foundation's funds up until about 2.5 years ago or 3 years ago, and then just stopped. And the reason that they stopped is something that Your Honors raised a minute ago, and that's the Ungar case. And I do want to make a brief comment about that. The Ungar case, to me, epitomizes what is going on, how somehow when Arab Americans or an Arab American charity is accused of being involved in terrorism, all the rules of evidence, all the rules of civil procedure, everything gets suspended. The Ungar case, the Holy Land Foundation never had notice of the Ungar case, was not sued in the Ungar case, wasn't named as a defendant. They had nothing the first they learned of that case was when the district judge in Rhode Island issued a writ of execution against Holy Land Foundation's assets after Hamas defaulted. And he did so on the basis that, well, the federal government has designated the Holy Land Foundation as a terrorist organization for its support for Hamas, so go collect from them. No notice, no opportunity to be heard, nothing. And at that point, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, because of the pendency of that writ of execution against the Holy Land Foundation, refused to allow Holy Land Foundation to hire lawyers, to use their funds to hire lawyers, and do anything at all about it. Now, as I gather, my impression is, although I don't know this for a fact, is that the Boehms and the Ungars are together with the federal government, are somehow in a tussle over the Holy Land Foundation's assets down in the federal district court in Texas. But there's nothing that the Holy Land Foundation can do about it. Nothing. It's a travesty that an organization could have a writ of execution issued against them without notice or any opportunity to be heard. But that is, again, what has happened in this case. And once again, it goes back to the designation. It's as though if the federal government is going to make this designation under IEPA, everything is suspended. There's some sort of magic. It's a magic potion that eliminates the rules of civil procedure. It eliminates the law. It eliminates the Constitution. Everything goes away as a result of that allegation. And the evidence that a court would admit, if this were not a terrorism case, if that were not the accusation here, there's nothing in the record that any court would admit against the Holy Land Foundation. And they would say, look, the Holy Land Foundation has stated under oath they never supported Hamas. They never did any of these things. They've got all this evidence to show that they shunned Hamas. And yet, here we stand. Summary judgment entered against the Holy Land Foundation. Never an opportunity to be heard. Never an opportunity to take the stand. And the evidence that they rely on, they say they have this pre-1996 evidence that Mr. Lewin argued about. The evidence that they have, which is completely unauthenticated, they've got a 1993 meeting. If you go to the transcript of the 1993 meeting, it involves all sorts of people, some of whom are alleged in the Watson Memorandum to be involved with Hamas, many of whom are not. It is alleged that Shukri Baker, the director of Holy Land Foundation, was there, but what's attributed to him?
Well, let me just say this. Official investigations into terrorist incidents often rely on hearsay. We know that now.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I know that, and I'm sure that they have to. I have no doubt about that. The question is, do we suspend the rules of evidence and the rules of civil procedure in civil cases where the allegation is, where they're trying to take this organization's property? One of the theories in the District of Columbia case was that it's not really a taking, it's only a blocking, so your due process claims go out the window.
I am going to have to stop you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I've gone on over time.
Is there one?
Well, I would say the only, and this is a minor, but I think it's an important point. My summary. I think I've probably worked myself up enough about the procedural issues here, but I do want to make a comment about this issue, this new case that was cited to the court, and that is the Ross Berger case, where it says the issue is one of abuse of the standard on appeals of abuse of discretion. That's incorrect. The standard on appeal for review of a collateral estoppel, application of collateral estoppel, is de novo as to the applicability of the doctrine, abuse of discretion as to whether it's fair to apply it in this case. I don't believe there are Seventh Circuit cases, and I can cite them. I had to go on Lexis last night to find these cases. There are Seventh Circuit cases that say the application of issue preclusion is reviewed de novo.
A supplemental letter?
And there are plenty of other circuit court cases, which I'll be happy to send the court in a letter if you'd like. That say that that's the two-part test.
Okay, we'll permit a
de novo and
we'll permit a supplement, of course. So we'll give you. We'll give you 7 days, and we'll give you 7 days to respond. Is that convenient?
Yeah.
All right. Or 10 and 10, considering the time of year, Mr. Pierce.